Our next guest on Downtown is a noted TV critic. You read his work in Rolling Stone. He's the author of a number of terrific books, including The Revolution Was Televised, TV the Book, The Sopranos Sessions, Breaking Bad 101, and his latest, Saul Goodman versus Jimmy McGill, The Complete Critical Companion to Better Call Saul. We're so happy to welcome back Alan Sepinwall. Alan, great to have you back with us.
Rich, it's always a pleasure.
I have to ask, first off, is writing about this Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul universe good for your health?
Well, it's funny you say that because, you know, the third to last episode of Breaking Bad, the one with Walt and Hank in the desert and Walt fighting Skyler and all these other terrible things, that aired the night I almost died from a ruptured appendix. And I stupidly told my wife, like, bring my laptop to the hospital room. I have to recap it from there. And then while I was writing this book all these years later, I was unfortunately dealing with some like very belated, what I was told medically impossible complications from that ruptured appendectomy. So I did wind up rewatching part of Saul also from a hospital bed. So at least it felt like old home week.
But the book is out and you're feeling fine now.
Yes, I'm much better now. Thank you.
Well, one of the things that has always struck me about Better Call Saul is, and you've written about it a lot, the lack of Emmy love. All those nominations, not a single win. And to me, most egregious is the fact that Ray Seahorn did not walk away with the trophy for what I think is one of the great television performances of all time.
Oh, I agree. Ray as Kim Wexler is incredible. It started out as this, I don't want to say nothing character, but this extremely minor character who eventually becomes not only the third lead, but the heart of the show. She's the most beloved person across either of these two series. And she was so tremendous. And I mean, in the book, towards the end of it, I did a long interview with Peter Gould, the co-creator of the show and the creator of Saul Goodman. And one of the two interviews we did was the night after the final Emmy shout out. And we talked about it for a while. And, you know, he's not bitter about it. He's disappointed, but it feels like some of it came down to bad timing and some of it came down to the fact that the Emmy voters kind of looked at both shows as one show. And there comes a certain point in the age of any series where it just will stop winning Emmys. And so by the time Better Call Saul came around, it seemed like the voting public was looking at this as old hat and they moved on to shinier things like Game of Thrones and then Succession.
Yeah, and you write about it as well. But part of it, I agree with you, is that these were not showy performances. So much subtlety in the work of Ray Seahorn, Bob Odenkirk, Jonathan Banks, everybody in the cast.
No, a lot of it is, you know, they say so much with so little. Banks, you know, it would see, you know, he would shift his jaw like 2 millimeters. And that would basically say as much as another actor would need a whole monologue to get across. And Ray, the same thing. You know, there's a famous episode early on where Jimmy pulls a stunt involving a billboard that winds up on the local news. And you see Kim and Howard Hamlin watching it on the news. And Howard is so annoyed and so exasperated with Jimmy. And Kim lets out this tiny, tiny little smile. And in that smile, you see everything about their relationship that's going to play out over the next 5 seasons.
Well, after the great success of Breaking Bad, not everybody was sure that a Saul Goodman spinoff was a good idea. And even the creators weren't quite sure where they would go with this character in the series.
No, Peter and Vince Gilligan really wrestled with this for a long time. At one point, they thought it was going to be a sitcom. They compared it to, I don't know if you remember this 90s animated show called Dr. Katz, Professional Therapist.
Yes.
But they thought maybe it would be Bob and a comedian in the Saul Goodman office having a half hour conversation every week. That was one idea. Another idea was he was going to be Jerry Maguire for Criminals, where he would be bringing together different teams to do heists. And even when they finally came up with the idea that they did, they still didn't really know what the show was. They thought he was going to be Saul Goodman by midway through the first season, at most by the end of the first season. And that season ends with him driving off into the sunset, very clearly having decided, I'm going to be a criminal now. I'm going to be Saul Goodman. And then they reconvened for season two and realized, wait, maybe that's not a great idea. Let's do something else. So they were really just making it all up as they went along. And ordinarily, I would not recommend that as a way to make any TV show. But these guys were good enough to make it work.
And Peter Gould told you they thought they would be in the Saul Goodman universe in that strip mall probably by the end of season one. But then everybody fell in love with Jimmy McGill.
Yeah, no, they were really surprised, and that the audience included. You know, that it becomes this show where when it starts out, everyone is so excited. When are we going to get to Saul Goodman? When are we going to get to Saul Goodman? And very quickly it becomes, I don't know that I want to see Saul Goodman yet. I really like this guy. And eventually that's the tragedy of the show. By the time Saul shows up, you do not want him there. And in fact, you barely see Saul in the run of the show, which should feel like a terrible bait and switch, but it doesn't.
What's the difference between Jimmy McGill's journey and that of Walter White?
Well, I would say it's Walter White is a man who is allowed to become a monster because the world thinks he's a good guy. And so therefore it never occurs to anyone that Walter White could possibly be doing any of these monstrous things that he's doing. And Jimmy McGill is someone who becomes a monster because the world refuses to believe that he could be a good guy. So every time he tries to do the right thing, he is either mistrusted or mocked or suffers in some way. And so at a certain point, he decides, you know what? You know, the world doesn't have any interest in this version of me. I'm going to become the guy that they all expect me to be.
Well, along with the characters from the Breaking Bad universe, we meet some new people. Again, Kim Wexler, first and foremost among them. And even that relationship became something that Peter Gould and Vince Gilligan didn't quite plan for in those early days.
No, they just wanted Jimmy to have a friend and a confidant, and maybe they had some history and maybe they didn't. But they really didn't think through much of anything. As I think Peter said, they could always only ever see about 2 feet in front of them at any given time. And they were just watching what Ray Seahorn did, and they were watching the way she and Bob Odenkirk worked together. And they saw, all right, well, this is something. And what I said before about how they came back for season two and decided not to make him Saul yet, a lot of that was they realized at the end of season one, Kim has set up a meeting with Jimmy with this fancy Santa Fe law firm, and Jimmy blows off the meeting. And when they reconvened, they said, wait a minute, he's hurting Kim. He's making her look bad. He wouldn't actually do that. And so as a result of that, they wound up, you know, delaying everything for years past when they expected to do it.
Yeah, the character of Howard Hamlin, designed to be a foil at the law firm for Jimmy. Patrick Fabian, so good in that role. And that character changed as well over time. You wanted to dislike him, but despite everything, he had a good heart.
Yeah, the original idea was that, as it seems to be in the first episode of the show, Howard is the bad guy who has never wanted to have Jimmy work at the firm, and Jimmy's brother Chuck is the good guy, you know, who would want to help Jimmy but is mentally ill and just can't stand up to Howard. And eventually you discover that it's the exact opposite, that Chuck is the snob who would never allow his brother into his hallowed profession, and Howard tried to do it, and he couldn't stand up to Chuck. And, you know, it's the writers looking at what the actors were doing and saying, this makes more sense than what we originally thought.
We're talking with Alan Sepinwall about his wonderful new book, Saul Goodman versus Jimmy McGill, The Complete Critical Companion to Better Call Saul. You mentioned the Chuck McGill character and the great Michael McKean, a friend of our show. And you talked with Michael about this. There's nothing likable. He is a jerk to his brother and to a lot of people, and yet you can't take your eyes off Chuck.
It's really remarkable how they decided on Breaking Bad. You have Skyler White as the voice of reason, and she is, you know, meant to be, you know, sympathetic and understandable, but there's a certain segment of the audience that turned against her because she was basically getting in the way of the premise of the show. You know, if Skyler gets her way, there is no Breaking Bad because Walt stops cooking meth. And on Better Call Saul, the voice of reason is Chuck. Chuck is absolutely right about everything Jimmy is going to become, but he is so awful and so condescending and so just difficult to be around, and also contributes so much to his own prophecy coming true that, like, you don't want to pay any attention to anything he has to say, even when he is 100% right.
And when Chuck's character dies, boy, as an audience member, I sat there thinking, well, this is it. That's the end of Jimmy McGill. But again, it's a tribute to the patience of Peter Gould and Vince Gilligan that even then, yes, it was a step in that direction, but the transformation wasn't complete yet.
No, every year when the show ended a season, I would have a conversation with Vince and or Peter, and always the first or second question would be, well, is he Saul Goodman now? No, this time, is he really Saul Goodman, please? And every time they'd be like, no, we don't think he's quite there yet. And one of the things Peter always said was, we will know he's Saul Goodman when me and the other writers start writing in the scripts above Bob's dialogue the name Saul Goodman instead of Jimmy McGill. And they didn't do it for a really long time. And they just sort of kept saying, even when he's using the name Saul professionally, he still feels like Jimmy to us. And it's not really until that episode, I think, third or fourth from the end of the show, when you finally see Saul in the present, and the script says Saul.
One of my favorite episodes, season four's Winner Takes It All, that karaoke scene with Jimmy and Chuck. But it's heartbreaking because you get a glimpse of what could have been in that relationship.
No, exactly. I think that there are certain things in Jimmy that would have made it hard for him to go completely straight. We see that a bit in the second season when he does get the Santa Fe job and almost immediately hates it and is trying to find a way out of it. But I think if Chuck had been supportive of him, if Chuck had accepted that his brother had reformed and was trying to do things the right way, I don't know that things would have gone perfectly for Jimmy moving forward, but I think they would have gone a heck of a lot better. And I don't think he would have become this absolutely amoral sociopath that we meet on Breaking Bad.
There was humor in Breaking Bad, but a lot higher quotient of funny moments in Better Call Saul. And boy, I think the high point for me, I still laugh out loud thinking about it, the squat cobbler.
Oh my God, the squat cobbler monologue. It's just, it's incredible. Like, here's the thing. Bob Odenkirk had no dramatic training whatsoever. I don't even think he'd ever studied acting in school. He was a sketch comedian who had done like sketch and radio and been a writer, and that was about it. And somehow he miraculously turns into this great dramatic actor over the course of Better Call Saul. And yet he's a comedian first and foremost. And so when they would give him a thing like the squat cobbler monologue, it's the delivery, it's the pauses, it's the emphasis, it's the way he seems so mortified when he finally has to spell out to the cops that squat cobbler is when a man sits in a pie. It's incredible. I would try to do an impression of it, but I could not remotely live up to what Bob does.
I love the story in the book about Ray Seahorn going to the set to watch Jonathan Banks and Giancarlo Esposito work.
Yeah, because she, up until the very last run of the show, Kim does not interact with Mike or Gus. And so, like, she would have no reason to work with them, but Ray is a student of acting, and she realizes, hey, these are two great actors giving great performances. Why don't I go and just sort of watch them and take some notes? And that's, not every actor would do that. Some people would say, I'm not working today. I will, enjoy my day off, or I'll study my lines for when I'm going to be doing my scenes. And Ray was always working and always learning.
I think it's a tribute to Vince and Peter, but also to the viewers of the show who just looked at the ages of these characters when we had those flashback moments and said, yeah, look, Jonathan Banks is not that guy he was 15 years ago. Doesn't matter. He's so good.
Exactly. And they would occasionally they did a flashback or two in the 90s with Jimmy and Chuck. And it's just it's not convincing at all. And it's almost silly. And yet you go with it because at that point, the show has bought so much goodwill. And I think to a degree, the fact that Banks looks so much older almost works for it, because Mike is so tired throughout the run of Better Call Saul. He so does not want to do all of the things that he's about to do. And I think the fact that Banks looks substantially older than he did on Breaking Bad helps with that.
Some of the new actors that joined the series, Michael Mando and unappreciated character, but got his moments toward the end of his run. He was phenomenal. And then the glorious Tony Dalton and everything he brought to the set.
Oh, my God. Those guys were both so good. The first scene with Saul Goodman on Breaking Bad, or one of the first scenes, they take Walt and Jesse take him out to the desert. He thinks they're the cartel. He starts trying to blame things on Ignacio. He's worried that Lalo sent these guys. And, you know, when Peter Gould wrote that script, he had no idea who Ignacio or Lalo were. He just wanted to suggest that Saul had some degree of history with drug dealers prior to meeting Walt and Jesse. And that's as far as that he wanted to go. And then they had to figure out who Nacho was going to be. And there was even debate in the writer's room as they got to the midway point of making Better Call Saul of, do we need to introduce Lalo? Is anyone in the audience even going to remember that Saul mentioned somebody named Lalo? And I'll admit that I'd forgotten. And I wrote a darn book about Breaking Bad. So it's just, it's a really deep pull. And yet they found Tony Dalton and he's incredible. And Lalo in many ways is like the ultimate supervillain of either show. I think if Lalo is alive during the Breaking Bad time, I think he sort of susses out the danger that Walt poses right away. And Walter White does not survive to do all of the things that he does.
Speaking of those connections and bringing back these references from years ago, can you talk a little bit about the role of Ariel Levine in keeping the story straight?
Yes, Ariel Levine was a writer's assistant on the show and eventually graduated and became a writer. But one of the things that she had to do was basically like sort of keep a running, you know, almost a murder board of the chronology of both shows and make sure that if somebody pitched an idea on Better Call Saul, it could not conflict with things that we had seen on Breaking Bad. So at one point, I think they wanted to have Saul make a commercial for Ted Beneke, who had been Skyler White's boss. And then Ariel Levine's like, no, Saul Goodman meets with Ted Beneke at one point because Skyler's trying to like slip some money to him by claiming that his aunt Birgit died and left him an inheritance. And so therefore he can't already know Saul. So you can't do that. There was a lot of that going on where someone would pitch an idea and then it would conflict with the canon, so to speak.
In your conversation with Peter Gould, it was surprising to learn that network executives in the Breaking Bad days didn't like the Saul Goodman character at all.
No, like there was some exec in either AMC or Sony who literally said, I don't like this guy. I don't think this is a good idea. Can you please throw out this script and start over? And Vince Gilligan, to his credit, you know, stood up to them and said, no, this is what the show needs. Please trust me. And they did. But it's amazing to think like that we almost didn't get Saul at all, which, and, I mean, both for this show, but just imagine what Breaking Bad would have been without that character.
Yeah. My jaw, I think, has never come off the floor after the episode Plan and Execution. We had Patrick Fabian on the show. He does a great Jonathan Banks impression. But I was so stunned that they killed Howard. And then what a masterclass in acting without a word of dialogue from Ray and Bob.
Oh, my God. That may be the best episode of the show. I mean, I go back and forth between that and a few others, like the one with the Bar Association hearing with Jimmy versus Chuck. But that one I really love because it's, on the one hand, there's this confidence scheme that Kim and Jimmy are running on Howard that plays out to perfection. And on the other hand, the episode itself is kind of a confidence scheme on the audience because you think it's going to be another sort of lighthearted caper episode of the show. And then all of a sudden there's Lalo wandering into the apartment and putting a bullet in Howard's head. It's just, it's stunning. It's incredible. The performances by Bob and Ray are just it doesn't feel like acting when you're watching. It feels like they have just watched their co-star Patrick Fabian be murdered in front of them. It's really quite something. And again, the fact that neither of them ever won an Emmy is shameful.
Well, and the scene with Kim Wexler in the airport shuttle, my God, that's just incredible.
Yeah, no, when she breaks down crying, that is, as you said, one of the great TV dramatic performances of all time. And it's, awards shouldn't matter that much, but I look at them to a degree as part of the historical record. And if someone is a TV fan 10, 15, 20 years from now, looking back at the Emmys, they're not going to see any wins for Better Call Saul. And so they may never be inclined to go check this show out. And the show is an all-timer.
How gutsy was it for them to take us for those last few episodes into the Gene universe and to shoot episodes in black and white?
I was not expecting that. I thought that at most we would get like a very brief kind of Gene coda. And instead, that's the whole end game. And it's the end game for the entire franchise because the last episodes of Better Call Saul take place after Breaking Bad. They take place after the El Camino movie with Jesse. Like, you know, barring some surprising development where 10 years from now, Vince decides to make another spinoff, this is the end of the show. And it winds up being very satisfying. And frankly, I think that the finale of Better Call Saul is better than the finale of Breaking Bad. And it looks great. The black and white is really cool. I was very, very surprised and impressed that we got that.
And for a show that the creators hoped simply wouldn't turn into Aftermath, it's a show that stands, I think, with the best television programs of all time. And I don't know if anybody can answer that question. Is it better than Breaking Bad? But it's certainly at that same plane.
Yes, I would say the best moments of Saul at a minimum are equivalent to the best moments of Breaking Bad. I think some moments on Saul are better than Breaking Bad. Some are maybe not quite as good. I think the Breaking Bad story is maybe a little bit more viscerally exciting. There's more stuff blowing up. The stakes are often a bit higher. But I also think that the people making these shows, they were just more experienced by the time they got to Better Call Saul. And so they were better at their jobs. And so, for instance, if you see in Breaking Bad did an episode where Walt and Jesse are trapped in the desert called 4 Days Out. And that's a great episode. Better Call Saul does an episode where Jimmy and Mike are trapped in the desert called Bagman. That, I think, is a better version of the same episode. Like, it's just sort of more exciting. It's better shot, everything. And so, it becomes a six of one, half a dozen of the other. You got to give Breaking Bad extra points just for coming first and making everything that Saul did possible. But the fact that Saul is even in the conversation is, to me, a remarkable feat.
Well, you mentioned the Bagman episode. Am I remembering right for the book that was shot after Bob's heart attack?
No, that was shot before. That was in season 5. Bob had his heart attack immediately after the plan and execution episode when they were shooting the next one called Point and Shoot. They're shooting the following scene where Howard is lying dead on the floor of Kim's condo. And Lalo is telling Jimmy and Kim what he needs them to do. And they were on a break in filming, and Bob suffered this just massive heart attack. I've heard it referred to as the Widowmaker, that specific kind of coronary that he had. And we didn't know that he was going to make it. And not only did he survive, he recovered well enough that they were able to, in not too long a period of time, resume. And they didn't have to change any of the scripts going forward. They had to maybe change the schedule a bit so that Bob wasn't working too many hours in a given day, but they were able to finish making the show. And obviously Bob surviving is the great miracle. That's the most important thing. But the fact that Better Call Saul was able to finish is still, came very close to that not happening, even if he had otherwise pulled through.
Well, yeah. And Peter told you that there was no plan B, right?
No, they were just, I think he said we were going to dump the show. There was, you can't like finish the story without Bob. Unless they just decided to want to bring in another actor to play him with the audience understanding, but I don't think that would have been satisfying enough. And it wouldn't have been disrespectful to Bob, but it's still, I don't think it would have been worth the effort. I think we would have all just had to accept, okay, this is tragedy struck and this story will never be finished. And, we will just have to accept that because what else can you do?
Well, as much as I love the series, what made it even better for me was watching the show in real time every week and then going online to read your thoughts on the episode. It added so much to it. And for anybody who loved the series or for anybody who hasn't seen it yet, this is such a wonderful book, and it's one I'll keep handy as I rewatch Saul Goodman versus Jimmy McGill, The Complete Critical Companion to Better Call Saul. Another great one, Alan. Thank you so much for this.
Rich, I really appreciate it.